You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's summer break for a lot of kids, but girls in Madison College's Camp Build are getting a crash course in hammers, power saws, and more. We'll learn about the effort to introduce girls to construction skills and a possible career in the trades. Right now, NPR is updating its ethics policy and, as one change, allowing journalists to demonstrate in certain situations. According to its ethics handbook, journalists can participate in marches, rallies, and public events that advocate for, quote, the freedom and dignity of human beings, end quote. That applies for in-person activities and on social media. But before they could take part in demonstrations, journalists would need to get permission from their bosses. The change comes as newsrooms around the country wrestle with where to draw the line between journalist and citizen, especially in the wake of George Floyd's death last year. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you've been following the story, what do you think about NPR's new ethics policy? In general, should journalists be allowed to demonstrate? If so, when and where? What kind of things do you not want to see journalists doing at NPR or any outlet? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kathleen Bartson-Culver is an associate professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. She's the James E. Burgess Chair in Journalism Ethics and Director of the Center for Journalism Ethics. She's also a visiting faculty member for the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. Katie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. I'm delighted to be here today.
Now, this is a change to one part of a very long ethics policy from NPR. What do you think of these updates, these changes when it comes to journalists' participation in public life?
Well, they certainly have churned up a lot of conversation about journalism ethics, which I always think is a good thing. The more people think about this, the better. I think they've been controversial in some parts because they have deterred from a pretty standard set of practices in newsrooms. But I think they're part of a really important ongoing conversation about how we can earn the trust of readers and listeners and viewers while not surrendering who we are as human beings.
Right. I think the old general rule, the current general rule for a lot of people in journalism is when in doubt, don't. Can you talk about how that works and how it's often applied in newsrooms?
Yeah, that's a pretty old adage in the business. Like if you're going to call me about an ethics question, if you're concerned about it, you probably shouldn't do it. But I don't want to make light of this because it comes from a really, really important and challenging set of circumstances that really caught fire last summer in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, but it's been going on for quite some time. And that is, how can we maintain neutral practices and fair practices within journalism while not clinging to some antiquated and quite possibly biased sense of objectivity? None of us are objective as human beings. We all have thoughts and feelings and we care about people, we care about issues. So you're not a robot. How can you make justifiable decisions in your reporting using objective methods, even though we cannot be objective as people?
The NPR ethics guidelines, they say, in a lot of cases, they aren't hard and fast rules. They're guidelines, check-in in particular circumstances. But one distinction that these guidelines make pretty clearly is if this rally or this event or whatever is calling for specific legislation to change or advocating for a particular political candidate, that's still out of bounds. Do you think that's a good distinction to make?
That's a good distinction in these particular rules because it's one of the clearer distinctions in these rules. There are some others that are a little foggy enough, I think, that they will be problematic. But not supporting a particular candidate at a rally, great. But they still do allow people to vote. Like, you can cast your vote for a particular candidate. So we shouldn't end the conversation at these guidelines. We should still be talking with reporters, producers, editors about, okay, if you do favor a particular candidate, how are you going to address that in your journalism? How are you going to make sure that your practices are actually neutral, even though you voted for one side or the other?
You mentioned the foggier areas. Where do you see the densest fog here?
Yeah, the densest fog to me is the line freedom and dignity of human beings. Mm-hmm. That is going to be seen very, very differently by different people. So, you know, the issue that popped immediately to my mind was the issue of abortion, which is very thorny. You could see someone in a newsroom saying, I'm going to go to this pro-choice march because it has to do with women's freedom. And you could have someone else say, oh, I'm going to go to this pro-life march because it has to do with the dignity of unborn human beings. So I think that this could get very, very fuzzy as they begin to work it out. But I will credit them with saying the first place that you should go is a conversation. You know, they say with your boss, I guess they have to give that, they have to give that hierarchical structure. The conversations within news organizations when it comes to ethics are very important, so that you're not just on your own making these decisions, that you are actually hearing from other sides and multiple viewpoints.
We're talking to Kathleen Bartson-Culver from the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication, looking at new ethics guidelines from NPR, updating extensive older ethics guidelines, but basically allowing, in some cases, for their journalism staff to participate in some kinds of public demonstrations or rallies. We are looking at the ethics behind that, some of the many gray areas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Katie, it seems like lately it's harder and harder to point toward any topic and have it not be politicized these days. I don't know. Is it hard to define parts of our lives that don't have a potential political controversy in them?
Told me 2 years ago that we would have a global pandemic and masks and vaccines would become a political issue, I would have called you insane. So we are in polarized times, and they're very surprising times. And I think that's why NPR very admirably pulled together this group of almost 24 people to address this. You know, if I'm a producer at Wisconsin Public Radio, and I put out a Facebook post saying, you know, I really think it's important for all of us to mask and get vaccinated. Under their old ethics guidelines, people had to stay away from quote unquote controversial issues. So to me, that post would run afoul of those older guidelines. And so I think it's good that they have this update going on, and that they're going to have conversations about what you can and cannot do in these contexts.
Another question that they bring up in these guidelines is, can you, if you're an NPR reporter, say, be on the PTA for your kid's school? Mm-hmm. Do we worry about if you're a member of a church, a religious congregation? They don't worry about that, that you can do that under these rules. But these ways that journalists in their daily lives might do some kind of public role and raise concerns of bias. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's always been one that's been vexing within newsrooms. And I think there's some people take the concept of independence too far. So one of the core tenets of journalism ethics that you see reflected in a lot of codes is that we ought to be independent of anything that might bias our reporting. And, you know, to use the PTA example, so you shouldn't be on the PTA because it might bias your reporting in some way. Well, it also gives you a really eyes wide open look inside what's going on in an education system. It's giving you context and perspective that you otherwise might not have. And so I don't think that is as clear cut. You know, who can be a religion reporter? Well, does it have to be someone who adheres to no religion? Does it have to be an atheist? Can it be none of those things? So I think all of these cases, we have to think less about the beliefs of a person and more about how they address those beliefs within their practices. To give you an example, I was a police and courts reporter for some years, and I personally am opposed to the death penalty, but I was working in a state that at that time had the death penalty, and I had to constantly be having conversations, checking myself, making sure I wasn't allowing those personal beliefs to influence my coverage. And I would be pretty open talking with prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, asking them what they thought about my reporting so that I was getting feedback to uncover potential ways that bias was leaking in.
We're talking about NPR's updated ethics policy with Kathleen Bartson-Culver on issues, the changes in this update involving What can journalists do outside of their reporting? What can they participate in? Demonstrations, rallies, that kind of thing? Kathleen's an associate professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism, and you could join in with your thoughts or your questions about the ethics behind all this at 800-642-1234. What do you think of NPR's policy, what you've heard about it here, or if you've read a reporting on that from NPR or elsewhere? Should journalists be allowed to participate in, say, a march, a rally, a public event? Are there things you think are okay? Do you think there are things that cross the line? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk on journalism ethics. NPR recently updated part of its ethics policy and now says it's okay for journalists to demonstrate in certain situations, those that advocate for, quote, the freedom and dignity of human beings, end quote. So to apply in person and on social media, NPR journalists would have to get permission from their supervisors, though. Kathleen Culver is with us, associate professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. She's the James E. Burgess Chair in Journalism Ethics and director of the Center for Journalism Ethics. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from your journalists, whether at NPR or Wisconsin Public Radio, your newspaper, wherever, when it comes to ethics? Do you think it's okay for them to participate in some kind of demonstrations, not others? Where would you draw the line if you were the boss in the newsroom? What question do you have about journalism ethics? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. And Katie, with your example a few moments ago, talking about a reporter with an opinion, it was you in this case, about the death penalty, but trying to make sure you overcome that in your journalism. NPR has a companion side of the part we're talking about exactly that issue, how to check your own opinions and your own biases to make sure you are doing a good job, a full job of covering whatever the issue is. What kind of things should journalists keep in mind? Because everybody thinks something about something.
Well, I think one of the things to keep for all of us to keep in mind is that bias is not only in the mind of the journalist, it's also in the eye of the consumer. So we have a pretty rock solid research showing that you can have a story that's sort of built to be neutral, and we encounter what's known as the hostile media effect or the hostile media phenomenon, that you take that neutral story and you put it in front of partisans on the left and the right, and they will both see it as hostile to their political viewpoint or their worldview. And so the same story gets seen as biased by different people. And it comes up all the time. You know, I'll hear from citizens, mainly in Wisconsin. They'll be concerned about a particular story and say, you know, isn't this honestly a textbook case of journalistic bias? And I'll read it. And I had one recently where I couldn't understand what the emailer was asking me about it. And I said, you know, can you tell me where you see the bias? And, you know, when he told me, I was very, very, very surprised by it. Some of the practices that we can all engage in are talking with people outside of the newsroom. So checking with sources, you know, hey, the story ran yesterday. What did you think? Any concerns? Anything I need to think about for future stories? Being open to commentary from our viewers and listeners and readers, even though, you know, just to be fair to journalists, some of those comments can get very, very toxic. And so it's not an easy thing to be monitoring responses to you. And then just staying open constantly to interrogating what you believe in, what you feel strongly about, and where it might be affecting your coverage.
I think that's really interesting, Katie, the idea that, yes, in fact, we could get a lot from hearing what our listeners or readers or whatever the case might be think about bias, but worried about the whole don't read the comments because some awful stuff happens in there. Have you seen a really productive mechanism that gets the really good stuff from the audience that can help then inform the journalist?
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting group. It's called the Trusting News Project. And they've had some research that indicates that when when news organizations run a story, sort of run like a companion piece to a story about why they're making a particular choice, why they did what they did. It improves trust, but it also improves engagement. So you hear more from the audience and you get better comments from them. So for instance, a paper that happens to have a mass shooting in their area, and they explain why they are naming the shooter, because for victims' rights advocates and survivors of those shootings, it's very controversial to name the shooter. They want the focus to be on anyone but that person. And so, you know, when that paper says, this is why we named the person, and this is how we're going to minimize the amount of naming, this is what we're doing to not sensationalize, that improves the relationship with the audience.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Marilyn is with us in Ellison Bay. Marilyn, hello.
Hello. I'd be curious how the resource person that you're speaking with today feels about the abolishment of the Fairness Doctrine, which I believe was in the late 1980s, and how that may have played out in its effect on biased versus non-biased journalism, and, you know, maybe some other factors that happened differently without the Fairness Doctrine.
Marilyn, thanks for the call. Katie, do you have thoughts on that?
That's a fantastic question, Marilyn. And yes, there definitely were effects arising from the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine during the Reagan administration. Probably the biggest one that we could point to is the rise of talk radio, particularly on the right. You would not have a Rush Limbaugh kind of figure if you hadn't had the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine. There are plenty of researchers who point to that as contributing to our polarization, that when we don't present multiple sides of an issue, it can lead people to only find those sources that reinforce their worldview and sort of drive them further into their own corners. That said, I think the rise of the internet happened regardless of what happened with the Fairness Doctrine. So you could have these politically polarized sites online rather than on radio, and we would see the same kinds of effects.
Marilyn, thanks a lot for that call. Katie, this isn't exactly on the NPR thing, but for outlets that have a news side and an opinion side, whether that's a newspaper with an editorial section or a TV network that has, you know, the Sean Hannity's of the world and things like that, but also a news operation at the same time. Are there different rules, do you think, for participation for the opinion people as opposed to the journalistic people?
Yes, you would see, Nicholas Kristof from the New York Times, very really important voice on human rights. Mm-hmm. You would see him participating in not just, you know, marches or protests, but charitable fundraising as well. Mm-hmm. So there are, you know, the rules have always been different for opinion journalists versus news coverage. But I would note that research also tells us that readers and viewers and listeners really don't detect those opinion versus fact-based news presentation differences in the way that a lot of people assume that they do within newsrooms. So, you know, we see a clear delineation between the editorial board and the news reporters at the, you know, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The readers of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel don't see that line as bright.
Thanks a lot for the call, Marilyn. We're talking to Kathleen Bartson-Culver from the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. We're talking about ethics in journalism after a change in guidelines from NPR about when journalists can participate in things like public demonstrations. Short version, sometimes yeah, sometimes no. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Katie, are there ways you think journalists should change their mindset to be more open to the concerns of their audience about bias, whether real or perceived?
Yeah, I have this great friend who asked this most compelling question at one of our ethics conferences. She said, when was the last time you opened your mind to something you felt really strongly about? And sort of everyone in the room kind of paused and went, well, it's been a really long time. And so I think that's something that all of us as just human beings should think about. But particularly within newsrooms, what are the practices that you have held to and just repeat it over and over again, that might be worth changing. And I think things like this NPR conversation are very, very good to help us sort of open our eyes to that. I'll give you an example. There are a few news organizations right now, the latest being the Associated Press, that are deciding that they're no longer going to report people's names when a crime is minor. So if a 17 or 18 year old is arrested for theft, should that person's name be actually in the report? Because it's going to last forever online and it will affect their ability to get potentially jobs, potentially housing. And then a few organizations, the Salt Lake Tribune and the Boston Globe being two big examples, are now taking requests from people to unpublish their names for, again, minor crimes that happened long ago and don't have any continuing impact today. They can petition the news organization to have their name removed from that. Other journalists would say that's absolutely ridiculous. We are the paper of record. We include names. If something happens in the public, it ends up in the paper, and that's the way things should stay. I think those conversations are vitally important now.
Katie, I'm looking right now at the website, npr.org/ethics, where people can go and read the NPR Ethics Handbook. Not always gripping reading, but it's out there. How important do you think it is for journalistic outlets to make this behind-the-scenes stuff public and to promote that this stuff exists?
Extremely important. I think we've been so closed, like kind of this walled garden of journalism ethics over the years, not talking about practices, not saying why we make the decisions we make, and that leads people to not trust us, to think that journalism is arrogant or it is cavalier, when in reality, really, really difficult decisions are going on in every newsroom across the country every day. Really tough stuff. Because often journalism reports on things that are very, very hard. We're reporting on crime, we're reporting on disaster, we're reporting on health crisis. And so people can be harmed by journalism. And one of the tenets of journalism ethics is to minimize that harm. But to talk more about how we minimize it, I think, is critically important. I would recommend anybody who listens to Wisconsin Public Radio, you might want to subscribe to the NPR Public Editor newsletter that comes out once a week. It deals with audience feedback to NPR, tackles questions, sometimes takes a very critical stance on what NPR has chosen to do. I think it's a good thing to sort of get an inside look at the decision making that goes on.
Katie, thanks for joining us again today.
Oh, it was great to be with you.
Kathleen Barton-Culver is associate professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication, director of the Center for Journalism Ethics. We talked about NPR's updated ethics policy and where lines are drawn between journalism, activism, and conflicts of interest. Up next, when did you first learn how to use a power drill? Some girls in the camp build at Madison College are getting that chance now. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The next time you hear weather in your area, you might receive a different kind of alert. We'll find out about the new categories of warnings the National Weather Service is introducing today, and how they make you safer and more informed. Now, kids look forward to summer break every year, but what if hammers and power tools were part of the curriculum? That's the case at Madison College's Camp Build, a half or full day camp where girls are introduced to the trades and get hands-on experience learning skills like drilling and pouring concrete slabs. Sandy Thistle is a construction and remodeling instructor at Madison College and an instructor at Camp Build. I talked to her earlier today about the project. Can you tell us a little bit about why you and the folks at Madison College wanted to do a camp like Camp Build?
Absolutely. So having been in the skilled trades as a carpenter for 30 plus years, recognizing the limitations to getting women into the skilled trades, and we wanted to try something different, and it seemed to me that the best idea was introducing girls at a very young age and ongoing to the sorts of skills that they would need in the skilled trades, so that it's less daunting and it becomes an option that they consider. Because for me, nobody ever talked about the skilled trades, and I sort of found it by accident, and it's been a brilliant fit for me and wanting to kind of spread the love.
I want to hear what the girls are doing. And let's start with the younger ones, first of all. What are they doing at the youngest levels when they come to Camp Build?
Well, this is the third year. The first year we rolled out in person and did the whole shebang. Last year it was all virtual, and this year we're in person again, but way pared down. So it really has varied from year to year based on those limitations. The first year they were doing things like even the kindergartners were spot welding, which is amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, welding is cool, and it got them pumped up. So all of the girls welded, did electrical, carpentry, and design. This year, we're really focusing on the carpentry and using carpentry tools. So this year, they are inspired by some girls in Texas who have a small business building three-legged stools and selling them for their college funds. We are building three-legged stools with the girls primarily this year.
Great. And for the oldest ones now, what, first of all, for the high school level girls, are they coming in with familiarity with these tools, or is this brand new to a lot of them?
It really depends. A number, I want to say maybe four of the girls that we had this year had been to Camp Build when they were in middle school that first year. So they did come with some skills, but even so, it had been a while since they'd done anything, and it's really pretty amazing to watch them advance. For the high school girls, we already did their camp over 2 days. There was a young woman who, on the first day, didn't want to use the router, and of course they can opt out of using tools that they don't want to use. And we have a small trim router, and she said, I don't want to do this, and that was fine. And then the next day, she used the circular saw to do a fair bit of cutting, and as she grew more comfortable, toward the end, the routing was the last thing that needed doing, and she just grabbed that router like a boss, because using the circular saw built up her confidence.
What are you hearing from girls after they go to the camp and maybe after they go for the second or third time about whether they'd consider a career in these fields?
It's sort of funny because there was a lot of media attention last week, and they interviewed Stella, and they asked her, they're like, okay, would you consider this as a career? And she's like, I'm only in ninth grade.
A little early.
Which was sort of funny, but it in some ways it doesn't matter. We can all use these skills in our lives.
Now,
and boosting the confidence and using the skills is key.
Now, it's been a day or two since I took shop class, but I remember in my day it was more boys than girls. There's still time for people to change their high school schedules, say, coming up. Would you encourage girls out there to consider taking one of the shop or vocational ed classes their school might offer?
Absolutely. I would hope to think that they would be welcome in the space. And actually, both of my daughters, I insisted, learned the skills that I use. And one of them went through my program part-time over 2 years and is now getting a degree in civil engineering. And really, the experience here learning to use the tools and in this environment set her up in a really unique and awesome way to be successful.
Sandy, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, and look out for Camp Build next year.
That was Sandy Thistle. She teaches construction and remodeling at Madison College. She's an instructor at Camp Build. She was with us today to talk about the half or full day camp for girls and the importance of getting girls involved in the trades. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an ode to a beloved first home.
Nigel and Amy O'Shea bought their first home in Madison in 2013. Now, they're departing Wisconsin after 15 years of building a life here. Nigel wanted to pay one last tribute to the house that he is so sad to leave behind.
11 steps to the basement, high above Beld Street. The prow of our ship, a two-bedroom bungalow. In the tides of traffic and the occasional train, our house is barely a skiff on the river system of Park Street. Among the buckthorn kept for the hammock, the spring lilac and the juniper, and Lou Reed, the tree stretching towards our power lines, there's Wingra and U-Haul and Arby's, its masthead light fading red, taunting convenience. Beyond it, the weather station hexagon sits on cream brick like a northwestern moon. The north adjacent lot is empty and unprotected, but for a gray breakwater wall holding in the seasons. When the grass grows, when the snow heaps, from shovel and mower, from mud to clover. A leaky aft porch where we sup in the summer will again see places set for starlight. As the snowmelt drinks wake the dead trees, spring hoists the green sails aloft, tying them to earth with flowers. Daffodil pegs and tulip cleats hug bebom planks. Aloft the curtains tug east and frame the view from our decks. Cats always watching or sleeping. Belled Street cresting and crashing day into night. The shouting air shakes with cars booming their long Doppler wakes, receding into the horizon, red as hell. A heat we only imagined in our fireplace because it never got a chance to char embers. Sometimes, time sometimes gets frozen in hot sunset during our moorage of counting days. Tidy but scuffed, this house is steered by ghosts. Our kitchen and orange galley clanking at all hours, and we are the current crew. When the bell sounds and we go below deck, let's hope we left it for the better. Good neighbors until eternity's end.
Nigel, Amy, and their daughter Flora O'Shea traded their two-bedroom bungalow in Madison for a Toyota RV. They're heading west towards family and into the sunset. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll talk about some brand new and hopefully more useful kinds of severe thunderstorm warnings the National Weather Service is rolling out today. That's coming up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, millions of Americans remain unvaccinated for a range of reasons. Families and health professionals are pleading with those who haven't done it yet to take their shot. How do you win over people who are still hesitant? That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, some changes are coming to the way we get notified of severe weather. Starting today, the National Weather Service is going to make severe thunderstorm warnings more specific. Not so much in terms of where they're happening, they already do that, but how strong they are and the damage they could potentially cause. Plus, if there's really bad stuff heading your way, there's a better chance you're going to know about it. Kurt Kotenberg is the Warning Coordination Meteorologist at the National Weather Service office in Green Bay. Kurt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Well, there are going to be some new categories, I understand, for our severe thunderstorm warnings. Kurt, can you walk us through what kind of different things we might see?
Sure. So basically, the severe thunderstorm warnings will stay the same in that the criteria of which we issue a warning at will not change. The biggest change will be when we start getting to the stronger and higher end storms, how we notify the public. So basically, they're going to be broken down into three categories. So we issue the warning, but then it'll have one of three options for what we call like a tag that we can put with it. First is the base one, then is a considerable, then there's the destructive category. And the destructive category is the one that we're really keying on here. So this is the one that has wind speeds of 80 miles per hour or greater, or hail that is 2.75 inches, which is about the size of a baseball, or greater. And basically what these new categories do is if we feel that our warning that the weather conditions that are being observed or are forecast to happen to the people, you know, unfortunately in the path of this warning, if we have those 80 mile per hour winds or the 2.75 inch baseball sized hail, what this will now do is this will trigger what's called a wireless emergency alert. So it'll basically trigger your cell phone if you're in the path of that warning, and your cell phone will be notified, will notify you and say that there's a destructive, potentially destructive severe thunderstorm warning coming directly at you.
It seems like it makes sense. Can you explain the reasoning behind the change, Kurt?
Sure. Well, part of it is we're just trying to, you know, kind of adapt and change with the times. Most people now have cell phones versus the NOAA weather radio. And, you know, basically our goal is to try to reach as many people as we can with the warning to protect as many people as we can. That's actually the core mission of the National Weather Service, is just to protect life and property. We aren't in it for the page clicks or the money per se. You know, we can't. We're federal government. It's legal. But just protecting life and property, which is why I love this mission and love what we do. And, you know, it's so important. You know, we, you know, city, urban, rural, wherever you are, we're, our mission is just to try to protect as many lives as we can. And so the main reason for this change is to, you know, get people on their cell phones. And then also, too, it kind of, you know, it's the next level of ringing the bell, so to speak. You know, letting people know that if they see, you know, their favorite television meteorologist on television saying, you know, yep, my area is in a severe thunderstorm warning, and, you know, so on and so forth, this rings the bell. This gets the, you know, the TV people aware and the people aware that, hey, you know, this could be potentially destructive and, you know, very life-threatening. You know, if you're outside and, you know, there's baseball-sized hail falling from the sky towards where you are, you know, that could be fatal. So this is, it's basically just to really, you know, let people know that this is something that they really, really need to take seriously and seek shelter immediately.
We just had that round of storms in a lot of the state last week. Would any of the warnings we saw then have been different if this new system had kicked in by then?
Yes, particularly the storm. We did a damage survey. I personally did one in Winnebago County near Amro and just kind of southwest of Oshkosh. I found the damage to be 80 to 90 mile per hour wind speeds. And I'll have to look. I think the Milwaukee office issued a warning that had an 80 mile per hour tag. And so those types of warnings were the ones that would have triggered the special wireless emergency alert. And again, that just would have given the people in southwestern Winnebago County that additional heads up that they need to take shelter, because this could be, you know, seriously life-threatening weather coming at you, which it was. I mean, there were just, you know, trees uprooted everywhere, and it was not a good scene down there in southwestern Winnebago County on our damage survey.
We're talking to Kurt Kotenberg, warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service office in Green Bay, looking at a new kind of warning based on the potential damage that a thunderstorm could do. At its most destructive, it'll light up your cell phone. Another middle ground based on hail size and straight line wind speed. You can call in with your questions about that, by the way, if you have one, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kurt, I've lived my whole life in the Midwest. I know when I hear tornado, hey, I got to take that seriously. It seems like we're paying more attention to straight line wind and the potential damage that we can do, or that it can do. Am I hallucinating here, or are we taking it more seriously these days?
Nope. And that's a good thing, and that's purposeful. As a science, you know, first off, we're trying to kind of incorporate the social science aspect of weather. You know, I can give you the perfect weather warning or the perfect forecast, you know, the best ever forecast. But if the public can't understand it and know what it means and know how to react to do what they need to do to keep themselves safe, you know, then it's not really a useful forecast if people don't know what to do with it. And so part of those, along those lines towards evolution, you know, one kind of, I don't want to say misnomer, but kind of unfortunate, underrated thing is that, you know, people hear straight line winds and just kind of like, oh, well, it's not a tornado, then okay, no big deal. But the fact of the matter is, what causes damage and injury and, you know, God forbid, fatality in events is all the things that are blown around by the wind. So as human beings, if I were to stand outside, you know, in an open field to 90 mile an hour winds, you know, I'll get probably get pushed back. But the winds alone probably won't kill me. Where all the injuries and everything comes from is everything that's in the path of those 80 and 90 mile an hour winds being, you know, introduced to myself. So, you know, a big giant tree in your front yard falling onto your house, or if you're standing near a window and it shatters, you know, the glass flying around at 90 miles per hour isn't a good thing. And so, you know, to the heart of the matter, we're really trying to communicate, you know, the 80 to 90 mile an hour winds, you know, particularly the ones that I saw or classified in Winnebago County, that is a weak EF1 tornado. You know, it can do equally the amount of damage. And, you know, in fact, straight line winds might almost be a little more threatening in that they can cover a much broader area. You know, if we think back to last Wednesday's event, there was damage all the way from Verona and Madison all the way to the Waukesha area. So just a huge swath of damage, you know, whereas a tornado is typically, you know, just a couple, could be a couple hundred yards or a couple hundred feet. So that's a much more confined area. And so, you know, again, we want to get the message out, and especially with these new destructive tags for if we issue a wind speed over 80 miles per hour, that, you know, this should basically be taken as seriously as a tornado warning. You know, do what you need to do, get away from windows, get to the lowest and most interior place of your residence, because, you know, this could be life threatening.
Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. So my question is whether or not the Weather Service is considering any verbiage change to the tornado warning, tornado watch category, because I ask people and they get extremely confused whether or not a tornado watch, we're watching a tornado, people have seen the tornado, quick take cover, or warning, 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 we've warning that there's a tornado coming. And it seems to me that every weather person goes on to explain to their listeners that either a tornado was sighted or the conditions exist, and it would be extremely easy to simply change the verbiage to a tornado has been sighted in this city or tornado conditions exist, and removing the whole verbiage of warning and watch entirely from our vocabulary. It is difficult. I don't think if I polled 100 people that 10 would get it right if the words were switched around.
Mike, thanks for the call. Kurt, is this something that the Weather Service goes back and reconsiders, the warning/watch words?
Sure. So that's an incredibly fair and good question. And it kind of dovetails into what I said earlier about how we're starting to involve social scientists in what we're doing. So I'll even piggyback one step further off of Mike's question. The SBC Outlook has categories right now based on the severe weather threat. So you just go to sbc.noaa.gov every day, and they have the kind of a expected risk potential for severe thunderstorms. And the categories right now as they currently stand are marginal, then slight, then enhanced, then moderate, and then high, which is the very worst. And there literally are people doing polls right now asking people, you know, given those five categories, how would you rank them? You know, is marginal worse than enhanced or is worse than slight? Like, what do those mean to people? And the feedback that we're starting to receive is it's confusing. Even some meteorologists are confused by the, you know, how to quantify and classify, you know, which is more threatening than the other. The short answer is we certainly are looking into that, and we are involving social scientists, and we are reaching out to the public and seeking their input. And I think over the coming years, I do think that we'll look at sort of evolving how we do that to really start to hit that sweet spot with public perception as to how they perceive and know what to do, again, to know what actions they need to take based on what we tell them is coming at them. But in the meantime, right now, as it is, you know, we'll just keep tornado watch means watch the skies. We usually try to issue that 3 hours in advance. or so. And then a tornado warning means something has been observed or is imminent. And that's when you need to take action.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. And Kurt, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Kurt Kotenberg is the Warning Coordination Meteorologist at the National Weather Service's Green Bay office. We talked to him about new categories of severe thunderstorm warnings that the Weather Service is rolling out today and how meteorologists survey storm damage. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow at 7:30, France, California, Italy, and Wisconsin. Take a tour of the wine industry here in the state. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the DNR is proposing what they call a conservative wolf harvest quota for a November hunt this year. We'll talk to a biologist about what that can mean for Wisconsin's wolf population and how other Great Lakes states are taking different approaches to the animal. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.